as a potential judges committee will have to order. It is 3:20 PM, February 20th, 2020. Yes, in Davis, Minnesota. Members present are Representative Jackson, Representative Lee, Representative Drummond, Representative Long, Representative Shire, Representative Tom, and myself, Representative Southwest Container. That the record reflects that we have a quorum to conduct business. And we're going to take a moment to please silence yourself under the direction of the meeting. Before we begin, as always, I'd like to thank Butch Clearwell, the Health and Social Services Reporting Secretary, and the personal attorney, and all of our staff in the committee today. Today, we will be hearing presentations from Derek Dozen from the State Health and Human Services Association, and also from the Bethel Housing and Homelessness Coalition. So, if our good friend, Mr. Dozen, could please come forward and introduce yourself to the record at the beginning of the presentation.
Today's perfect day to meet with you guys. We have our annual flying going on, which means I just left a room with several of our hospital CEOs, nursing home CEOs. We have ED physicians there, practice managers, really good group of healthcare people. And this morning, we spent a lot of time talking about healthcare and the ways we can address it. And so today, during the presentation, I'd like to talk with you, and please, by all means, questions at any time to help me. To the end, but the title of the changing landscape is what I'm going to know is healthcare is constantly changing.
Thank you.
Thank you for an overview. We're sure with why healthcare. I haven't discussed that, and I'd like to set a question for folks that came into this room, and I think it's important to talk about what exactly is changing. We're very engaged with that in Alaska. And what should we focus on? What are good things to identify? So I am healthcare. You guys know this. I know this. A lot of people surprisingly don't. Hospitals and nursing homes contribute $4.5 billion to the Alaska economy. I know when I was flying out from New York about 3 weeks ago, there was a banner in the airport that said, "Support Alaska Tourism." We put in $4.5 billion into the Alaska economy. And it was perfect timing because I had that aha moment. You know, some people struggle with understanding the impact of healthcare. If you struggle with it, think of tourism, we're right there with you. But if you're in the Southeast alone, 9% of the workforce is in the healthcare industry. And industries have had 24% wage growth over the last 3 years. That means it's a really attractive profession to work in. And the economic impact just in the Southeast. We saw almost $569 million in direct impact. So again, while healthcare is peace, healthcare is economically relevant, and that's all about this. But the real question is, what is changing? And you all have answered this in so many different ways, right? I know you can do it in athlete, you can look at state, you can look at funding. What we typically do is everyone is obsessed with the question of cost of care. Cost of care is very high. So what is the response to that? What is the movement? If you pay attention to any of the answers, you can actually have a specific feeling where healthcare is going or just look at any of this. And it's sort of at the national level, we're doing the same level on local. So if you look at this and you start with Medicare, you will quickly realize that the overall demand is healthcare is going to an ambulatory setting whenever possible, at more cost than it is far more accessible. And so, what does that mean? How do I say that? Start with Medicare. Medicare is a huge driver of healthcare policy in the country, as it should be. But it comes with a hospital drug, which I gave for idea changed that. It's that we had a cell phone in Dallas, we presume total knee replacements are actually outpatient procedures. It's a fundamental shift in the way you reimburse, and it's a fundamental shift in the way you care for it. Because essentially, it's clearing the way for this to go to the outpatient world, which is generally cheaper, and it's less time spent in the hospital. And not only did Medicare do that, but they said you can do these procedures in the ambulatory surgery centers. So the writing's on the wall. Everything you start in, you go to the outpatient world, to that ambulatory center. And that cost, I mean, it's kind of silly for me to put this out there. I'm going to talk about this constantly, but number one, it raises the cost of care too high. Hospital believes that, facilities believe that, and it's a challenge we have to solve. When you see that put out in Medicaid, it's funny. Every year we have a conversation about, you know, is Medicaid sustainable? Is this a cost we can afford? Everybody wants health care to lower cost. We know that. But I feel like at the local level, transparency laws are helping everywhere around the country. It's happening nationally. Nationally, we're already in hospitals who are putting out their charges to the federal agency, to the website, to the Phoenix Hospital. And then in Anchorage, you know, there's push for transparency. We post things in Representative Spotlight, who have a very thoughtful building around the fact that they get legislation that's pushing transparency. It makes sense. Now, in whatever world these women really don't exactly understand what you're buying, I'm fairly educated. I have experience in the healthcare industry, and I can tell you, I get very confused when I'm determining what's going on with the benefits and the cost of care. So you take those different audiences and pay attention to them, there is no doubt this is the demand. We want to care with the ambulatory setting at a lower cost, and we want it to be far more accessible to the consumer. So I talked to this about you with you at Vero, briefly from Healthcare in general. What is that looking like last year? And I think it's important to talk about it one more time. We have capacity challenges in Alaska, and those capacity challenges make some of this national change look a little bit different here. So at the hospital standpoint, we average 2 beds per 1,000 people. Let me tell you, there's only 8 other states with a ratio that is less than that. So that means if you compare us to around 50 states, we're on the lower end, generally speaking, for acute care beds. Let me also tell you, many of those other states have robust community systems in place to provide a viable alternative for hospital care. We do not. Another challenge is, as you guys all know, this 21% of our beds are not accessible for the emergency system. That is a challenge that is absolutely unique to the industry. Unfortunately, when you think of long-term care, some of your traditionally speaking nursing homes, that's what you think of. We have the fewest beds in number per capita by facility size, no matter which way you cut it. Which way you analyze it, we have the fewest beds in the country. And that is a major problem. And I'll show you the money.
On this long-term care facility, so that I understand this a little bit better, because this is an issue with our aging population, and you mentioned nursing home care, but also I've heard it come up in the context of mental health care and trying to resolve the EPI issues. So that's the appropriate setting for the acute response, but then we need other facilities. And so are these 19 only, taking patients that are in the elderly category, and how can we address that and that need? What should that number look like to better accommodate that? And in other locations, are they state-run facilities, private owner, or a combination?
Great questions. Through the chair. Well, first, in using traditional skilled nursing facilities, nursing care, that's the facility I'm talking about. So it doesn't necessarily matter which one you use, it's one of the criteria for that type of care. And there are people who are far more qualified to answer that than myself, but that's the basic. If not just the elderly, that certainly is a population, because generally, as you get older, those are conditions that require care, but it goes beyond that. statistics, which are great for high schools and nationality, if you look at acute care beds for behavioral health, we also are by far the minority than anywhere else in the country. And those are the UTI bed beds. These are the beds that exist in Fairbanks, and I really brought that in pieces to Jim and now in Patsy. They're beds that come with very specific behavioral services, and including psychiatry. Fire rate is a secure environment, usually in Providence has also those beds. But the API problem in not having those beds, that is a true crisis. And I wish I could have brought all of you with me this morning to hear the stories that I heard. Again, you know, I've been away from the hospital that I worked at for a few months now, and you know, to get away from it, you stop seeing it every day. It's like, I kind of stopped thinking about it as much, and all those feelings came rushing back this morning. So, if you take this slide in the presentation, this is one of the continuum of care in the third life cycle. We need this up. It's not, you know, pretty hard or anything like that, but it's just a graph to try and put things in perspective. What you want is you want robust community services, because that is the cheapest place for you to receive care. So, behavioral health is a piece of it. You want as much counselors, peer-to-peer support, you know, supported housing, whatever you can get in the community, that is your best investment from a pure cost standpoint. As you need more services, you will higher up in this hierarchy or this pyramid. So, you know, if you can't get served in the community, you can't get your services there, or you have an issue with your primary care, you have to go to special community. If that's not working enough for many of the crisis, where are you going to have your emergency? You all understand that. It's the idea of officially accessing care. You step on a path to the higher level of care. And yet, many people talk about the reverse. Once you're up there, once you've received the care, the real story is how do you get down from that? So, in other states, you may see this nice graphic, and people can say, as you need the higher level of care, you will go get it. And as you finish receiving it, you will basically move down. So, if you're in a hospital, you're ready to be discharged out of the assisted living care. You're in the assisted living facility, it's going to be a lot cheaper to be there than in our hospital. Here's the problem. When we talk about the capacity numbers I brought up earlier, it creates bottlenecks, and we don't have that efficiency and ability to flow within our continuum. So here are a couple of examples. I know I came from the landed form diagnosis meeting. Direct experience of being at Johnson Regional is, well, then, if you become eligible for Medicare, which is one of our populations rapidly aging, if you're eligible for Medicare, it's impossible to find a primary care doctor. The reason for that is because, frankly, Medicare does not pay very well for primary care services. And Medicare patients are highly engaged, so they're more and more time and effort. So, basically, primary care physicians are saying, we can't see a business of its kind need the full Medicare plan because we just don't get paid enough money to do it. So what happens in that situation? You're not getting treated. When you get sick, you get sicker, and so what are you going to do? You're not going to get brought to the hospital emergency room. I'll stress this. In hospital, the hospital emergency room is the most expensive place for you to get care. For good reason. We have the most advanced technology. We are open 24 hours a day. Constantly have staffing and physicians on site, it's supposed to be expensive. But if you're not supposed to happen, you're not supposed to go there unless you absolutely need to go there. And that's the problem. I use the reverse angle. I'll share this with you. What people don't know is if you want to go to the hospital and you're medically clear, sometimes you can't get out. And that's why you're going to wear from long term care. So I'm going to read you an example. And this is a very real example. This is a phone call to a couple of facilities saying, hey, do you have any stories about your ability to discharge? Can you send me a couple of statistics? I have patient answers within minutes. We have one saying we currently have a patient who has been ready to discharge. Somebody said, but we're going to the hospital. The doctor said, you need to go. You don't need to be in the hospital. They could see it in their self-serving 17 days after being medically cleared. The reason was because there's no nursing home bed available for the patient. So they just sit in the hospital. seen that the adolescent population, generally, when facilities like at the time of this information in December, is that when a 13-year-old kid has been on the third floor in the hospital for 30 days. And the reason he's done that is he's severe autism. There's nowhere else for him to go. He had no medical reason to be in the hospital. Just so you're right, that patient's been 64 days there in total. In that facility, he's 13 years old, he had autism. And his dad was a 12 kid. And as the commissioner said, they had 26 staff assaults during his stay. Here's the problem. Nurses are running, doctors are running, you have to take care of the patient. And you're either getting through some of their mechanism and their strength wages, you're either getting no funding, or you're getting severely underfunded for this care. So when people ask, well, why is the cost of healthcare so expensive in Alaska? The large part of it goes back to capacity. And people don't realize that. These are two stories that I just shared with you. I can go over right now and get dozens of these from all around the state. Not just the main hospitals, not just the, this or that. And it happens in long-term care as well. Adults want to nurse and home care patient care, and they know a lot about criteria of care, and they need to really know how to see the living facility. And it took them 8 months at Glacier. And during that 8 months, all of that care went as uncompensated care. Because you don't have the criteria of care to be able to scale the nursing facility. So that's something to really consider when you're talking about progressive changes to the ambulatory setting. We have real significant capacity challenges that you really have to factor in when you're thinking about this. So this is my last slide. I'm happy to take questions at any point, but what do you focus on? How do you make sense of all this? It's hard. It's overwhelming. I think the first thing that we try to convey now is capacity is really fragile. It's not something to be ashamed of, but it's something to realize we're ashamed. But also don't worry about it. I want to just be totally candid that it's one thing to do this when we get a rate raises and different treats with Medicaid. But as we're giving consecutive years, you start getting compounding effects, and you basically start underfunding services, and it just exacerbates the problem. Because access to care becomes jeopardized, and providers start closing up or whatever may happen, you're just creating a much brighter pathway in that emergency room. And that's going to always be the most expensive place to land. And so let's give kudos. The department has been great. In my 10 years so far, they have been great to work with. We've been engaging. You'll know this. The capacity issues are not their fault. I think it's something we're trying to advocate to them, and I think they definitely understand. We need to be mindful that we're making policy decisions to not jeopardize that further. So I definitely want to commend them. We want to just, you need to support innovation. And so something that has cracked the surface and some of the care that goes out in the general healthcare system. But the work they are doing is years ahead in many respects of the work we see in other aspects of the healthcare system. The coordination that goes on there, the ability to transfer and have a tertiary learning scholar and have the system that we're working within some of the population of, there's very great things happening there that we should be building on. What I have left on here is what's going on with the South Central Foundation. I can't speak, but not only as an expert, but it's called the NIMBY System of Care, and it's received national awards twice, nationally. And it is all about redesigning healthcare delivery to focusing on the customer, the patient, and their needs. That's a teaser for you, but the Department of Medicaid has received national recognition, and we're doing it really well here in Alaska. We should build on that. Crisis is here, right? And not only will we want to spend money, I know everything is precious from a healthcare dollar standpoint, but you're part of the hospital here in general who's invested in crisis intervention to try and keep behavioral health outside of the hospital. Try to be right there on the street. Try to create that environment so that people are not going to emergency rooms, people are not waiting for beds to be out of or down it. And the idea behind that is exactly what I said earlier. They're trying to deliver care in an ambulatory setting hard to keep burning in the door section, and it certainly is accessible to the consumer. In that case, it's a better law for the consumer. In chronic care, we see prominence, we see that, so we see other hospitals that focus on ED utilization. You can demonstrate real progress if you start coordinating care, especially around the world. Prominence has been there for the last year, not the same data for a year, and there are some major savings, especially for the visits to the emergency department. And just in closing, people say, oh, what to focus on, what to focus on. It's really far from finished, in my opinion. We saw in the long-term forecast from Medicaid last week or month. And I know there's tons of talent at that point. But don't look at the last 2 slides. 73% of our spend in Medicaid comes from people with chronic conditions. If you do the math, people with chronic conditions in Medicaid are about a quarter of that population. So the fitness is literally a quarter of the people driving 3/4 of their spend. That's where you can focus. We are working on right now, and after working with our providers, especially as we do our flying, we were really anxious to come up with specific solutions. Other kind of cluster projects we can work on, whether it's some peer coordination, demonstration efforts, and we all agree, we see a lot of different levels of past, and start just trying to, and we all know the solutions, it's nothing new, but maybe the way we approach it, and we're real excited to approach the department, work with them, and see if we can get buy-in and support. We know dollars are precious, but at the end of the day, I just can't emphasize enough, certain policy decisions, certain cuts, just think about it. What do you end up doing when you need to or not? You're just making that emergency room light a lot brighter, and I can tell you, it's a lot more expensive, and that is what drives up cost. We need to focus on getting people treated more efficiently and effectively in the right environment. So that's my presentation, and I'm happy to take some questions if you don't have any of that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. I really appreciate your presentation today. As a legislator who is eligible for Medicare, I am fortunate to have active state employee insurance coverage. I hear that Medicare reimbursement in all 48 states is fine, and everybody's happy and people love their Medicare, and a lot of lessons I'm sure in order to get that care. What is the problem with Medicare for people with them? Is it the level of reimbursement? Is it has not been adjusted? Is it a federal issue that we've had no help on?
I'm not sure if it's a great question. The problem is related to the capacity slide. When we talk about the three other states, what kind of capacity from the view of just acute care coverage, they have robust health systems built around. So access to care is a lot much trickier than it is here. So I know, and I don't know the exact numbers because I know there's been reductions in that, but the statistic is often talked about that Medicaid pays, it's on average 26% higher than Medicare in Alaska, and so many people say, that's the idea. That's very nuanced, because that's not true for all Medicaid services at all. It's generally for physician services, it's certainly not the case for hospital services, and that has been ratcheted down over time with some of the cuts we've seen here. So, to answer your question about, is there going to be more for you, we're going to get this money or not, the cost of recruiting specialties, the cost of employing people, the access challenges in rural areas, our small population pockets, all of those are challenges that do not exist in the world for you. So a Medicare may be able to very attractive down there. It is not very attractive here in many instances.
I'm on the budget subcommittee for corrections in the Committee on Community and Regional Affairs. And we have been told now for several years that 65% of the state's mental health treatment and medication is provided within our prisons, which have a population of roughly 5,000 people. Is Ashton aware of that? How is that fact in relation to the mental health services that you mentioned?
Through the chair, this is where it's totally unfair. I'm going to do this in my own initiative. So I think at the hospital that they should almost get very united with our community and the health providers, because we know if we have all the money in the world and we went right, we would build all the amazing beds. You can see we can bring our capacity out, do the math beyond par with the lower 48. It will fail because we do not have the services at the community level, and you're just going to see the readmissions. Our scores today, we've had patients born in our emergency department. Pay for transport to get them to API. This is no fault of API here. We're all for insurance. But the patient gets discharged within 72 hours. It ends up back in that hospital's emergency department a day or two later. And I have multiple CEOs telling me that today. So that is a crisis in the true sense. And it's an expensive one, too.
Just a thought, just getting off of Representative Durham's comment, and then and had an interesting conversation with some healthcare stakeholders from the interior today, and we were talking about how API is a component of the solution for mental health services in America, but largely there's a mental health crisis in terms of capacity and meeting need for mental behavioral health and substance use treatment across the state, and API is just one component of that. So I just hear that echoed in your line of conversation today, Representative Clayton.
Thank you. Discussion on that link. So, my question about the crisis in emergency medicine, that fairly general, they're actually they've taken some time to try to create at least an outpatient crisis in medicine. What is there anything in terms of the cost factors? Are they able to bill for the crisis prevention? And how is that doing? Does it pay for itself? And is it covered by insurance if you have that level of knowledge?
I'm not talking about that level of knowledge. I think some things I can speak to. The hard part, when you have hospital systems that are committed to invest, you know, one thing I can speak from personal experience working in the hospital, we gave the green light to a project that got inpatient behavioral health beds. And the chairman's absolutely correct. Please hear me. I echo what you tell what she said. We built inpatient behavioral health beds, even though I think it came up around 60-70% of the payment. 60-70% of patients with a primary diagnosis of behavioral health and coming from our doors were Medicaid patients. That's a disproportionately high payer mix for Medicaid. That means if there was going to be Medicaid cuts, that could have a huge effect on the project to be sustainable. We built that project, even though there was risk of cuts, we had 5% cuts last year, and I'm sure we'll touch on the entire this year. We built that because there was a benefit to getting the 7 to 10 patients reported in our emergency room for 10 days at a time. There's an economic benefit to just get them out of there and make care rendered in a better way than that for people in the emergency rooms. And it was better for the patients because we had a better chance that they were going to come back and use up those resources. So what I'm trying to get at is it's not always can you build for this as a community service. Sometimes we have gold standards, but economically and from a system standpoint, it makes better sense because what are we left with? You know, and ideally, if you have a come up the capacity, and ideally we would have crisis and hygiene centers and it would work in tandem and take the pressure off the rest of the system. But right now, it feels like we're not near that. I think the building is not hospital services, which is obviously far cheaper than hospital-based services. So I think that kind of putting your own hat on there for colleges from now. You don't know about insurance, but it would be far cheaper to spend 23 hours in the crisis intervention center than to walk into an emergency room.
I would just note that a lot of what you described seems very similar to what we actually talked about with the insurance problem and the improved care kind of on the shoulders both before and after when you get into the emergency, when you get into when you get people taking inpatient, that gets to be a very high cost driver, but to the extent you can do that before they actually get to the emergency room or when they're released from the hospital, have better services, probably so that's that shoulder period. Those are where you really start seeing significant improvement both in the cost of care and the result of the care provided.
From an anchor titan, one of the most performing healthcare projects that has happened in the last 5 years. So, that being had, and hopefully, I'll see a vascular and a medical center in Kennedy and the other, and it's actually that you create a respite care at the Brother Francis shelter. And it's profound. We have some guarantees for the competitors, funding, over resources to create respite care so that there's a safe place to discharge patients that are homeless, so that they have the chance to have sustained recovery outside hospital doors, which is cheaper for them, it's cheaper for the system, it's cheaper for Medicaid. Everybody wins. And in theory, you can't do that over and over again because that's kind of the way hospitals are paid. It's steps like that where you're trying to address both sides of the visit. I mean, it's pretty profound stuff in my opinion.
Thank you. And I do want to say that Mormons of Life Community Health, South Central Foundation, and the Grant Administration Project, and I think South Central Foundation offers the care. If you highlighted in your presentation that tribal health's success, and that I think one of the reasons that tribal health has been so successful, and not just in the system of care, but with the whole system, the system as a whole, is because it's integrated. Their funding structure is different and it allows them to build out the system to meet the needs and to realize cost savings if they invest in primary care or behavioral health care and reduce the emergency room and keep their utilization down the road. And you have a whole bunch of efforts that were being under PDDs and Medicaid as part of a driver for reform in the state that I think you also looked at earlier in your presentation. To drive reform in the state of Alaska, there was a new student demonstration project that was just pulled back on this last year, and there was coordinated care demonstration project. I think there's a lot more opportunities. Especially because I feel like we've lost some of the momentum when it comes to healthcare reform. I'm interested, what would you do to drive system redesign and a system where we don't have integrated care for those of us that are outside of the tribal healthcare system? How would you drive that change?
With a generic, great, great point. I just came up with my answer at the end of last week. We've tried this so many times, and we've tried this big movement, and I have learned, especially working in a facility, I'm talking to a facility, everyone has these ideas, and building off what you said with the demonstration projects. So if we know that care coordination has worked at a minimum to some degree with saving millions of dollars by targeting, let's say, ED utilization, that's just one example. And in all other facilities, I've heard other facilities say they're uniquely suited to all of our facilities. We don't do very light. And so as you go to a different market, I have one facility saying, we do a global budget. We're here and we're one of our providers. We know we can do it. Let's go do that. So I'm just going to answer your question, what I would do. I hope we can play the role in this afternoon is, rather than thinking about this as one big healthcare policy, Medicaid policy, and we don't have to get on creative and comfortable. We should start funding. Hear me out, man. I'm not asking you for money in a second, but we should start funding individual projects. We should look at individual projects as the answer, not one big project. So here's an example. If you have one facility that thinks they can have another global budget, and another facility that thinks they can reduce ED utilization, I would make this part up. Let's say, if I'm a social worker, if I had one FTE for care coordination, I know I can target these 20 people. I know if I reduce visits by X amount of times, I can save millions of $2 million, $1 million. If we can come up with a math in the individual facility and come up with a proposal, and you guys are willing to make that investment up front, we'll return your money and plenty after that. And that's the things that we should focus on. It only works for a year at a time. Eventually, you have to work on shared savings and other things to make it sustainable. But if we can come up with cluster projects, I mean, not maybe it's a job goal, but if we can keep coming up with those ideas and things that we do, that is one thing we should talk about. That is an opportunity for change.
Mr. Clifford, you know you have a board meeting to get to. We have time for one more question. You're doing it for me. when you're sort of just describing the opportunity first for some projects, and I'll this small player and everyone listening, we're going to try to get some samples here. I think that there's some interesting models that have been utilized in other states where there are savings. The savings is split, and it's split between the state, and it's split between the community and the community. For example, in Eastern Oregon, there's an Eastern Oregon coordinated care project where the savings are split between the state and the community, and the community then uses those funds to reinvest in social determinants of health. But I'm interested in whether or not ASHA is interested in exploring any of those kinds of projects.
Genuinely believe, I would like to put together my own money here and not just be fake, but the reason I've been successful is because of those signals that add up over time and make the difference. And so it would depend on, do we have a number that's a things they can do to go? We can scope out the project and open the specifics. A lot of these are locally owned. So if they're interested in something like that and they think it can make sense, we will do their biggest help. Work on the hard part is you need to do some modest funding up front. And I think the attractive thing of doing these small projects one at a time is we can demonstrate a return on investment. We can do it every time, and your return will probably come in the second year. But you need to be willing to put out whether it's an FTE or something modest up front. So I think the answer is yes, there would be interest, and I think that's what we're going to work on this year. Can we come up with a list? Is it time now that we can take greater than what we think in the process?
Thank you so much for your presentation and for your time today. Please be aware of the project if we maybe slightly delay.
That's why we're working. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a brief break since we start the next presentation. Thank you.
some of the terminology we're going to be using to just hit some of the high points that our bottom sustained continuity of care, whether it's the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, Alaska and Hawaii Sustained Continuity of Care. We have Anchorage, and then we have everybody else. And so we're part of everybody else. We have been participating really actively with the project Homeless Connect, which is an independent kind of to be able to services and collect data on the homeless population down at the level. And over the last couple of years, we've been really successful with the data, especially during the point in time count, which is in the city of homeless, and you have a chance to sort of gauge the homeless population in our community and where they are at that particular point in time all across the country.
We recognize our time is limited, so we've also put this information in the slides in the handouts. When we first formed, we are going to came up with sort of three goals, and it was basically to provide our seasonal homeless shelter to be an all-year shelter. We wanted to look at indoor housing first, because we got that from some of our other projects we had listed, and we wanted to address youth homelessness. And those goals have been grown a little bit. We've also gone explore homeless or grant-supported housing or housing first. That's really grown into a lot of data collection. And we need to know who is homeless in our community and what services they're utilizing. So data collection and analysis of that data has really snowballed as we continue on throughout these years. And our youth homelessness has really grown recently. With the statewide effort to come up with community needs assessments and pathways out of homelessness for specifically youth homelessness. And then also our coalition, which really just started with interested people, interested, passionate people at around the conference table in KWC, formalizing, creating an MOU, coming up with a specific who's on this MOU, then including community members, and our strategic plan.
As a coalition in rural communities and pretty significant accomplishments in the last few years of our work, the Community Foundation that I work for has made significant investments into coalition and the mental health shelter to expand our efforts in collecting and understanding who is homeless in our community. We talk a little bit about myths about rural homelessness in a few moments, and we're really getting the data up here now. We also spent a fair amount of time researching housing first with a permanent supportive housing strategy. And the data, and those of you who are in Anchorage, you know, you have a number of housing first projects there. It's indisputable in terms of the effectiveness of using funds to homeless people who are experiencing homelessness, in particular, one of the most chronically underhoused individuals, the most vulnerable individuals in our communities. As a coalition, we made site visit trips to Toledo and Anchorage Housing First projects in order to sort of verify our knowledge about these opportunities for permanent supportive housing. We're also now voluntarily participating in HMIS, which is a HUD-required database for entities that receive that funding, that you receive that funding. We are not receiving funding that requires HMIS participation. But we are a part of that system now, which was a significant accomplishment for our community. I want to point out that the safety net for homelessness in our community is extremely thin. The state investment in homelessness in our community is also fairly insignificant right now. But I will say that the funds that are coming into the community are used extraordinarily well. So, two examples of state funds going into address homelessness to the community of Buffalo Standardized Coalition, which receives homeless assistance program funds through BHC, and Buffalo Warehouse Shelter, which receives community initiative matching grant funds through Health and Social Services. Both of those are relatively small investments, both making major impacts on our community. The other funding that comes into our community to address homelessness is federal funding. Our regional housing authority is implementing veterans funds just for homeless veterans through a voucher program, and our local tribe receives HASDA funding. There are no current continuum of care care funds entering the Lake Victoria Regional Continuum of Care, which is a theme you will hear about here, is a funding that comes through HUD with an HFC match to address homelessness at various levels. Recently actually announced that there was $2 billion for continuum of care across the country. In Alaska, this is population-based. About $4.68 million came into our state for 30 projects. You can see from our slide, most of that was awarded to 15 acreage-based projects, with less than 900,000 being awarded to the rest of the state for 11 projects. Participation in continuum of care is something we're very interested in expanding in the near future. The most recent time that our community had continuum of care funding, which was Taylor Williams Coalition several years ago for transitional housing. HUD, however, has prioritized permanent housing, but this again indicates that's where our resources are most effective, which means that not particular project for transitional housing less competitive. Right, we're going to talk a little bit about Bethel's data with that area.
Before we go into this a little bit, I was just kind of could you help me understand, like, kind of the context of the homelessness situation in Bethel a little bit, but just sort of set up the numbers here? Shelter. Besides requests for shelter for domestic and sexual violence reasons, the only one reason that we're called this is just homelessness. That was because of homeless houses being overcrowded, either in Bethel or the surrounding villages. And that's not where, besides what our mission is, that's what we call the shelter. That's difficult because it was brought to our guy side.
Interesting.
Thank you. Following up, I wonder if there were a number, a general number of the homeless population that you're talking about.
Yes, there is a number. Our local law enforcement believes we have between 60 and 100 homeless people in our particular community of Bethel at any given time. In a few moments, we'll unpack that data and talk about the conditions folks are experiencing and what we are discovering at our data collection related events.
And I want to add that also, again, it's difficult to say with Beth Bevel, but Bevel communities and other agencies in Bevel are also regional providers to agencies. So that's, depending on what data collection is going on in the village community, that's really hard to figure out, but like, certainly.
Our data collection efforts and our concentration right now is primarily Bethel also say that we're going to get into this data because even among ourselves, there were a lot of myths about the people experiencing homelessness in our community. And we're trying to identify them. We can share the results of some of the information that we have unpacked in recent months. And this has been really important to us in terms of identifying what approaches and what solutions we feel will be effective, because as close as we are to these issues in Bethel, even among us, we did not fully understand folks experiencing homelessness until we asked some very targeted questions. So that's where I get to come in. Hopefully, I can make the numbers interesting. I think that they are very telling. And as Michelle said, they're telling us in ways that we didn't expect in some of the aspects. So we've done a few really specific data collections and analysis so far. We've analyzed the warehouse data from the previous season. We've done, as Josh talked about, a few of these project homeless kind of events, and at these events, we've done various forms of surveys. In January of last year, we did one of the first project homeless connects on conference in that community in that building that we haven't done in a long time. But those surveys were anonymous, which is still really good information, but really going to be information that we can track from time to time. So starting in October, we started doing non-anonymous surveys so we can understand not just the number of how many people are homeless, but who's homeless and what are their specific needs, and being able to track those over time across the same people and be able to see how many people are new people to homelessness in our community and how many of the same folks that we've seen before. So for those three major collections, we've got reports that are available, and those will be a lot of the data that I'll talk about today. We've also got some ongoing observing data collections. We did another Project Homeless Connect last month in January, and so we'll be reporting a few months for that. And we have our next meeting time now scheduled for April 15th, which is during the last week that Winterhouse is open for the season. And then we'll have new data from Winterhouse. It'll even be more robust than this year because of some revised paperwork. So those will be coming in the coming months. So we want to start with looking at CNBC's data because that is still an important factor in looking at homelessness data.
Right. So CNBC has been around for over 40 years, and when in 2009, a new shelter was built to be a shelter, and that increased our capacity from something like 25 beds, I think, to 33 beds. And just this last January, we increased again to 43 beds. I think last time I checked occupancy of the shelter, we were at 46. It's very difficult for us to be between 45 and 50. In the last fiscal year, we provided shelter for about 370 undocumented people, including 137 children. Winterhouse has been able to shelter children, so we're about the only facility that can provide that service. Frankly, about 10,000, almost 11,000 shelter nights, 5,000 of which are children shelter nights.
So the next data collection that we're going to look at is Winterhouse from the previous season, so not where we're currently at, but from last year's season. It was open for 4 months, and there were 216 individuals served, including 181 overnight guests. So when you look at the KBC 180 adults, and here we have 181 overnight at Winterhouse, right? It's pretty comparable that this is a 4 month season. And the other major difference is it's, overnight said, we can't serve children at Winterhouse, and they're not open during the day. It's not a day shelter, it's only 9 p.m. to 7 a.m. And so the numbers are still larger than back the year before, and with about 2,000 shelter nights. The largest census tonight was 32, that includes both the dinner and overnights, with an average of 17 people every night. None of the nights were at least usually about 10 guests, 64% were between 10 and 19 guests. A quarter of the nights served over 20 guests. over 6,000 people. And I think that's helpful to see, like, okay, so maybe having great, it's not necessarily huge at those numbers, but 200 distinct individuals per season was, I think, for the animals, pretty shocking that there were that many people that came to their house for services. Looking over the season from December through March, the averages are actually roughly the same every month. They're a little bit higher than in December, but they're actually pretty steady across the season. So people are really getting to know your house the full season. It's not just when it's from, you know, the depot winter, it's for the full season, including new people coming in every month. So it's not just one core group of people, although there is a core group of people who are moving people every month. It also did not correlate with the weather. The fluctuations that we made were not due to it being really cold. So I was able to, you know, look at that and, one of the warmest days was also one of our highest days in March, so it's not connected to the winter. Which, in terms of the cold, it identifies one, yes, of course, we're saying why it's when it's really cold, and people are needing it when it's not as cold as well. So, looking at the patterns of when people are having each individual guest is staying, you have first five, about a third of the guests are only staying one night. The whole season they stay one night. So if they're just staying one night. So we really are breaking down kind of two major groups of people. People who are staying less than a week, which for last year was about 70% of people stayed less than 7 nights. But that means there's about 12% who stayed at least a month. It may not have been all consecutive, but there are some people who are really using this long-term shelter that has a long-term shelter for the ones that it's open.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that one, you were saying that the winter house is the 9 p.m. to 7 a.m. based on the day services. So then, for those individuals, when you're talking about, you know, if they're having like longer than 7 days of stay, then they're having to like give them more and kind of like move out and figure out what the date of the day and come back every night.
$80,000 to run the shelter. You can see there our state fund data was about, what was it, 36,000-ish. So there was about the fund raised on our own. We applied for various grants and went to various companies to try to raise the money. But we actually applied to stretch those dollars quite a ways. You can see our cost per service, overall cost per review cost was about $40. The case that came in just for meals cost us about $1 million a night. We're about on the floor at 2 hot meals and then back on the street. We're not a solution to the problem at all, but we are keeping people alive and we're looking to take that next step.
This component of data is incredibly important to us because there is sort of a belief in rural Alaska, there is not homelessness, and this data is compelling. It tells us there is, in fact, homelessness, and there are, in fact, sheltered people who rely on winter housing, introduce heating, and in a moment, you'll see other locations people sleep in. And it also is critical for us to understand length of time and who are most, and the conditions experienced by our most vulnerable neighbors, so that we can design the appropriate approaches to provide services and interventions for those populations.
I just wanted to take a second to speak to this slide because this is a population that our hospital really isn't meeting. Some of our guests accounted for 25% of our total costs, 25% of our overall shelter needs. These are people that need permanent support and housing. And once again, we're keeping them alive during the winter because we're not doing anything to fix the problem. And when they're not with us, they're in the emergency room, and the police station, they're in the back of an ambulance, and they're not going to stay alone.
share. On that, could you help me understand how those individuals are made to that significant advice? Are you needing to provide extra services to those individuals, or is it because of their income standing? Is that what you're just a simple analysis of looking at how much it costs per night for people to stay there. And I'm not there that many nights, so it was, I think it was really interesting to find out when you're seeing that simple analysis. We're not looking at the staff spending more time with some of you, you're not, that's not, like, this is very baseline, but that it's, 3% of the guests were accounting for a quarter of the hosting services.
Thank you. I just did a quick calculation, and that works out to about $715 for each of those 7 guests per month of the 4 months period. But I think Anchorage has found a similar number, which is why Housing First is so important. It's much cheaper to actually help them with housing, and then everything else comes along. So, I can see why it is so valuable.
Thank you. That was really important for us to look at as well. And, it's not about really understanding these specific guests, there's a need that's deeper than what they're able to get right now. And that's why we think something like permanent supportive housing would meet the needs of those high utilizing guests, whereas some of these other guests who only need a shelter like for 7 nights at the most will still need more health for that.
It's not either or, it's a health and fitness for both and. Because there's not just a one size solution, there's, couple different problems going on that need a couple different solutions to fix.
What's
the
nightly
capacity of the warehouse?
And if you want
to call the beds, the floor in the church?
About
45. Okay, thank you.
So, just briefly, I wanted to talk about the January 2019 unfortunately, with the first chance at analyzing surveys that Project Homeless came up with, where we did indicate major, 58 people who have been in surveys or were observed were possibly or definitely homeless. And because it was January of last year, we were also open, and over half the people who were surveyed at Project Homeless Connect had stayed at Greater Health the night before. So that also means less than 50% did not, and they were often. So we're most recent analysis that University of Philly and the summer report for is the October 2019 Project Homeless Connect surveys. It was the first time we got to roll out some of our more in-depth questions and having it not anonymous so that we could understand individuals and what their needs were over time. And whenever it's not due to work in January, I think part of that is due to the microwave in October than it was in January. And Greater House was not yet open for the season, so how people find out about it, people go to the library a lot during the day, and so they were doing much about, let people know to come to this event, and I think it's in the same location as the library. And there also actually less online standing up to the museum in October, and that does impact our numbers as well, because they are included in these numbers. So, just a quick couple of notes on the demographic side. That we had a huge age range of 21 to 78, which is really wide. And the gender swing actually potentially more even on how people would guess. And so that was pretty interesting to us. We also started asking about disabled and conditions, including alcohol use, drug use, physical disabilities, developmental disabilities, mental health, and chronic health conditions. And 69% of people who were surveyed in October reported having at least one disabled condition. And there were actually 2 conditions per person on average for the people who said they had a condition. Importantly, the people who said that they have a condition, they said that half of them said that it prevents them from having stable housing and employment. So we look at what needs to be to address these issues. It's not just that people need housing, but they have specific barriers that have come through how we look at chronic homelessness. So even if they're sitting friends and family right now, how long have they been on the streets or homeless in the last 2 years? And half the people said it's been more than a year. So we've got half that are dealing with something probably pretty chronic, and half that may be dealing with something hopefully less chronic. We can't agree to we need solutions for both, right? So the people who are sitting in something shorter, maybe a safety net like in their house, or staying with their friends and family, that works. But we also have at least about half the people who are in chronic situations and need a longer term solution.
Thank you. Is there any time? Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for starting with this. I appreciate it. I have a good chair on that previous slide. I'm very, very interested in this wondering with us, the 24% group. Did you learn anything more about those situations and sort of like how you're encountering someone sort of running down the road up there?
Said he was in a residential, so he's not in stable housing really for his whole life.
smaller communities. I'm curious if there's been an analysis done of this data alongside other communities in the state.
So some of our urban communities have done a lot of work with data and have some reports about their data, especially around like housing first-based solution and effectiveness there. I attended this fall on AML conference on housing homelessness in municipalities, and based on the attendees who are largely rural Alaskans in that group, I did not hear from any other rural Alaska communities that they're doing what we're doing in Bethel right now with the data. In fact, I had a number of rural communities approach us and ask how we had gotten to this place. So I think with maybe a little bit of exception, we are fairly unique and rural. I'm really careful to try to compare our data to urban centers because there are a variety of how you ask the question and people's understanding of the question. I'm not certain we would be comparing apples and apples.
And then can you talk a little bit about the work with the funding that's made all of this audit election possible?
Our community foundation, our local community foundation, has funded all of the data collection efforts thus far. Slides, we're going to get into what I felt were some myths that we hear around the state about rural Alaska homelessness and some myths that we told ourselves about homelessness in our own community. So, there's no answer to what I'm talking about. I'm a big fan of Colin Cowan. So, this was about last, there were a few questions about location. The first one was, where are you from? And the second one is, where have you been for the past year? What we found is that 77% of people are from the villages around Bethel, and 17% are from Bethel itself. But 86% of the people that we surveyed have been in Bethel for the past year. So one of the myths is that, oh, people are just, you know, from a village or from Anchorage, and they just want to go back because they just got there in the next step for whatever reason, they're just trying to go back. Well, maybe that people originally from the village, that's what this data shows, that 77% were, but they've been in Bethel. They've been there at least a year is what they're saying. And so that was one of the things that was really helpful for us to understand. So then the next questions we asked were, well, what would you like? Do you need to just get back to where you have a permanent place? Or do you need a permanent place to live? Because that's one of the other myths is that people, they just want to get back to wherever they're from, and they can't go anywhere and say you're stuck in Bethel. Well, that's not what's going on. When we ask people about this, 80% said they wanted a permanent place to live. So then we asked where we wanted to live. The options were Anchorage, Bethel, another Congress Bethel village, or Bethel. And 71% of people said Bethel. Additional people who, there's a couple people who want to be in Wagner Village, there's a couple people who want to go in Village or Anchorage, one person is in Anywhere, two people are like either Bethel or Anchorage. When you look at it, it's 71% of the people who want a permanent place to live want to be in Bethel. And when you look at people who are willing to live in multiple places, altogether that's almost 90% of people want to live only in Bethel or Bethel or somewhere else. So when we're looking at where do we need solutions, we understand the data, but we've got people who are homeless in our community. And then we're understanding from talking to those people, they're apologize. Yeah, we do apologize. I will have Google Slides to back our point and then email and have a couple of weird formatting things since we're working collaboratively on this from various locations around the state. But I do want to stress that for us, our local coalition, our needs are really statewide needs. And that means investments in the homeless assistance program at the state, the FedMAP program, and the HRC, the community initiative matching grant program, which is health and social services. And that means that we look at making sure that we have funding at adequate levels. Now, the good news is last week there was a House Finance and Bill Substitute for Constable 206 that puts homeless assistance program funding up to $8.15 million right now, and that puts SNUG up to $3.7 million. Those are investments that we highly support. They're competitive investments, there's no guarantee. Our local groups are offered to receive any of these funds, but it sets us up to apply for funding that could make substantial differences for folks in our community now that we know who they are and what approaches we need to engage. I would also say that right now you're looking at four people who have other jobs. Each one of us have other full-time jobs. And there is not one single person strategically working on homelessness in our community or in our region. There is nobody who's paying attention to this as their job, as their only priority. All of this work has been done by a coalition of people, perhaps some of whom are on the phone, four of whom are in this room, who are doing this in addition to. And I really want to thank all of my co-workers and volunteers here who have made all this work very possible. But for us to move to the next stage, we need to get real about what's going to, what we need in terms of human resources to really move on these issues. You've heard us say we need a year-round emergency homeless shelter operating out of a church at night, and it's time for us to find a permanent location and for them to have permanent staffing. And we need the permanent supportive housing approach. We've determined that that's housing first. We are very impressed with that model. We've researched it in the Anchorage, we'll continue to research it, and that's the direction we're moving for permanent solution. We, while we're doing all of this, are also focusing on youth and participating in all of the youth roles. Demonstration project plans happening around Alaska. Anchorage has a light safety program that their programs are rolling out now. The rest of the state, those plans are happening now.
Just really quick, I think people are really excited that it looks like there's been an adjustment to the funding is getting close to the 2,000 levels on it up. I keep in mind that's flat funding for almost 12 years, and costs are going up, so when you fund something flat over that period of time, it's actually a net decrease, so I just wanted to point that out and to pay attention to that, and it's quite, we're very happy that the funding's been restored. But it's not going to be due to the cost inflation or the increases in cost.
I just wonder, because one of the things we hear a lot about in rural perspective, when it comes to say public safety and education and lack of housing, is always like an issue that's brought up. Did you consider, are these in any way related in terms of if we took care and address some of those other needs? I'm not sure if that only addressed capacity issues in places that were more overcrowded. Affordable housing and housing stock in general is a major issue in Alaska. It's certainly a significant issue in Bethlehem and our region in the Lightning Delta. If we had more affordable housing, there is a population of folks who are remaining state would likely be helped substantially. It would also help with rapid rehousing approaches. Trying to get parenting to children, that was good. But for rapid rehousing or for voucher-based services, you need some housing stock available in order for people to have needs to move into. Now, another rapid pulls like close to 0% vacancy rate. So not only is there a population of folks in the workforce or entry-level jobs who are struggling to find any place to live. But in essence, there's a whole other strategy we didn't talk about today around rapid rehousing that we didn't really even touch because we don't have any occupancy. Is anyone else going to hear about this? I do want to acknowledge that Alyssa Leary, who is also part of the Housing and Homelessness Coalition, has been online during the testimony today. We thank Alyssa for what the message is. I'm personally glad that you might have funds and we can hear more about your definition of what happiness
is. Homeless Assistance Program funds, it's administered through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And that funds, I think what you see, it funds emergency shelter-related costs, but it also funds placement dollars, helping people with first month rent and deposits and utilities and private market rental and subsidized rental housing situations, and also private evictions. So the most important thing that we can all do is private evictions, because when people become homeless, it's so very expensive, and that kind of money will help with those prevention-related funding activities.
Thank you all for really appreciating the data that you've collected. It's actually incredibly illuminating, and I think others are working to try to gather it, but the fact that you're gathering that, what is essentially a volunteer effort, and the picture that it gives you as community providers and gives us in terms of some of the challenges that are down the face of our communities is incredibly valuable, and so, and particularly for that level of research you presented.
Just a personal note of thanks to my friends and neighbors who came all the way to do not to participate in this with us today. Just for the community's education, working at the local bank manager, the local community foundation, the advocate, and the students, children on the hand. It's really incredible to see the amount of collaboration and public partnership with regard to the resources that we're being spent on doing this work and how this is really goes. And just in the earlier best communities across the state, but even in the most remote communities. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
I do recognize that the next meeting of the Housing and Social Services Committee will be Thursday, February 27th at 3 p.m. here in Davis Room 106. We will be hearing three bills, House Bill 242 related to the prescription of opioids, and House Bill 189 related to the notification of family members of a child who is in state custody, and House Bill 184 exempting veterinarians from the adverse consent drug monitoring program. The time is 4:48 p.m.